Hello and welcome to Max Politics. This is Ben Max coming to you from New York Law School and its Center for New York City Law. Thanks for tuning in for the show. We have a special edition of the podcast here for you on this episode. What you're about to hear is the audio of a live event that we hosted here at New York Law School and the Center for New York City Law earlier today, which is Monday, April 15th, 2024, in which I interviewed New York City Deputy Mayor Maria Torres Springer. Her portfolio includes housing, economic development, and workforce. And we were talking specifically about the Adams administration's housing agenda, and within that, most particularly about what the city wants to see from the state in a potential housing policy package that is being negotiated as part of the next New York State budget. The state's fiscal year began April 1st. We're now here in the middle of April. They've passed a few budget extenders to pay the state's bills while Governor Kathy Hochul and the legislature continue to negotiate the budget, which will come in at roughly $235 billion for this fiscal year and is likely to include a lot of policy, including housing policy. And there's a lot of high hopes among many that there will be a big housing policy package. And that is a lot of what we're discussing with Deputy Mayor Maria Torres Springer at this event, as everyone is waiting for the final word on a state budget deal. Again, lots of high hopes that it will include a lot of housing policy, but from New York City to many other stakeholders, there's a lot of concerns, of course, about the details. So we got into a lot of that. What does New York City want to see from the state on housing policy to help it advance its housing policy that it is also working on at the city level? A lot of focus on increasing housing supply and housing development, but a number of other pieces of it as well, from the city's point of view, from advocates' points of view, legislators, and many other stakeholders that are involved. And there's a lot at stake in terms of the design of some of the specific housing policy pieces. So we got into a whole lot of that and much more in this conversation. What you're about to hear is a short introduction at the event by New York Law School Dean and President Anthony Crowell, and then myself in conversation with Deputy Mayor Maria Torres Springer. As we sit here and I record this introduction to the event we held this morning, the state budget is being negotiated. There might be an announcement any minute. We are expecting, again, it's not guaranteed, but are expecting that the parties are coming to an agreement on a housing policy package. But a lot of what the deputy mayor said in our conversation will apply to sort of evaluations of whatever they decide on in Albany, which the deputy mayor, Mayor Adams, and many others from the administration have, of course, been trying to shape the contours of that deal. And you'll hear us discuss that as well. So here is Dean and President Anthony Crowell, followed by my conversation with Deputy Mayor Maria Torres Springer.
Good morning. How are you all today? Good. Good, good, good. We've got a full house. Love that. Lots going on. I'm Anthony Crowell. I am the Dean and President here at New York Law School, and I want to welcome you to a very special briefing on the New York State budget with New York City Deputy Mayor for Housing, Economic Development, and Workforce, Maria Torres Springer. As New York's law school, over the past 133 years, we've always felt a very special responsibility to engage on the key legal and policy matters affecting New York and to serve as a resource and partner for government and vital civic organizations all along the way. That includes one third of our graduates today entering public service and public interest roles, mostly in New York City and state, which has allowed us to say that we have the second highest number of law school graduates in the United States entering public service just before Georgetown University. It's a real point of pride for us. As always, I want to give great thanks to Center Director and Founder, Professor Ross Sandler. Ross, he brought the Center for New York City Law to life 30 years ago with such vision and leadership, and it has created a foundation for our unmatched programs. And I certainly want to acknowledge Mrs. Alice Sandler, who's here as well, who has been a co-host of the Center. I also want to welcome Ross Moskowitz, who is a member of the class of 1984 and a trustee on our Board of Trustees, for being here. We love when our trustees come. Thank you. And special thanks to Ben Max, our executive editor and program director at the Center for New York City Law. Ben is relatively new to the center, but he's been a phenomenal force since joining us, and so much Good is happening, building on Ross's rich legacy, and we're all excited as he hosts this briefing today. I will say that we also have a number of new team members. We welcomed recently distinguished fellow and counsel to the center, Stephen Lewis, who's from the New York City Law Department. We're also proud to have senior fellow and director of the Census and Redistricting Institute, New York State legend, Jeff Weiss. We have CityLand editor, Veronica Rose, and I want to just acknowledge City Law Administrative Coordinator, Rose White, who's the connective tissue and keeps everything running. It is important that as we move forward, we understand that things in our state are difficult at times, and we may hear an announcement about the budget as early as today. We had hoped when we scheduled this meeting, this breakfast, that it would be done. And Ben and I were like, well, what's the right date? Is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? And we're like, I think the 15th, you know,
you're
relatively safe. No. I'll blame me. You know what? At the end of the day, everyone does. Why not do this one? So, we had hoped, but I nonetheless think there's a lot going on. We might hear an announcement as early as today, but we're fortunate to have the deputy mayor here. The deputy mayor and I go way back to our days as relatively junior staffers, junior staffers who rose in the Bloomberg administration for many years. She was an incredible force in those days, and I couldn't be more proud to see all she's doing for our city today. It makes good sense that she's in the role she's in, and we should all be proud and feel good about having someone with her mind and her leadership capabilities at the helm of this incredible portfolio. I will also say that there are a number of people from her portfolio here. I want to give a shout to Team NYCHA, who's here. We have NYCHA CEO Lisa Bova Hyatt, NYCHA EVP and General Counsel David Rohde, who I have to shamelessly say I'm his proud spouse, and then Executive Vice President Arvin Sahoni and many other of the high-level talent at NYCHA. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ben to begin today's conversation. And again, Deputy Mayor, thank you for being here. We're very, very excited.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dean Crowell. Thank you all for being here this morning. Thank you, Professor Sandler and Alice Sandler. Where'd you go? thank you both. And thank you to Veronica Rose again and Rose White, who helped make sure that everything came together here today, as well as our great events and marketing teams here at New York Law School. Very happy to be here this morning and happy to be joined by the Deputy Mayor. Thank you for being here. We have a lot to discuss, so I won't give your full bio, but I'll very briefly say that Maria Torres Springer is the New York City Deputy Mayor for Housing, Economic Development, and Workforce. Before joining the Adams administration as deputy mayor, she was vice president of U.S. programs at the Ford Foundation. Prior to that, working in multiple mayoral administrations, rising to lead three different agencies in the de Blasio administration for housing, economic development, and small businesses. She has vast experience in government and public policy, and over the last two plus years, especially has been designing and spearheading the Adams administration's housing agenda, including efforts to win major changes in Albany to help New York City grow its housing supply and make a real dent in the affordability crisis that has obviously been such a challenge for our city and the surrounding area and the state, the homelessness crisis that we face, and the broader challenges facing New York City around being a place welcoming to people of all means and backgrounds, a place where people can afford to move to pursue their goals and dreams, to stay as they get older, to raise a family, and more. So there's a lot to discuss about how to get there. The ongoing state budget negotiations in Albany are, as Dean Crowell was saying, unfortunately ongoing, but I've been texting and emailing people throughout the weekend, trying to get a sense of where things are at. We're going to get into a discussion about what the city wants to see from a budget deal in Albany that might, and people think likely will, include a significant package of housing policy. So let's begin there. What are the main pillars of what New York City wants to see from Albany in a housing policy package deal that maybe you have insights for us into how likely it is, but what are the main pillars that New York City wants to see out of Albany?
Great. Well, first of all, good morning, everyone. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Dean Crowell. Thank you, Professor Sandler. Thanks to everyone. This is a great room for a number of reasons. There's a vast city government diaspora in this room. And I also had the pleasure of meeting, hopefully, people who will be part of that diaspora in the future, but appreciate the invitation to be here. You know, Albany sometimes breaks our heart, and sometimes that includes not quite the right timing for a briefing like this, but I think a lot of these issues, despite us, I think we're at the 1 yard line. And that for me is a good thing, Ben. It's a good thing because I think there has been incredible awareness and acceptance of the housing crisis that we're facing in this city, state, and frankly, in this country. You know, when I talk about this and with you know, different communities, I often traffic in the language of really sobering statistics, right? And the latest housing vacancy survey is no different, where we see that we have a 1.4% rental vacancy rate. That is the lowest that it has been in 60 years. And the availability of apartments that are the most affordable, that vacancy rate is functionally zero. I wouldn't even get to levels of rent burden, in particular for the lowest income New Yorkers and Black and Brown New Yorkers. All of those statistics are sobering, they're heartbreaking. But what that has meant for us is that on all levels of government, and I'll get to Albany in a second, of course, city, state, and federal, we have been incredibly motivated to collapse the difference and the distance between awareness of these issues and action to actually bend the curve. And so what has that meant on the state level? We've been clear, we were clear last year, we've been exceedingly clear in this session that we need in this city a set of tools to boost supply, because fundamentally what we have in this city is a housing supply problem. In the past decade, we've added 800,000 jobs, but only 200,000 homes. And so what has that meant? That has meant real human consequences for New Yorkers, tipping the balance more in favor of landlords than of tenants. And so the rising rents, displacement, incredible pressure on maintaining the housing stock, those are the human consequences of our supply problem. So we have been vocal and explicit about what we need. We need a replacement for the 421A program. And, you know, I say that explicitly. A year ago this time, you couldn't even say the letter and the numbers 421A. You'd get yelled out of the room. But obviously, the lawmakers and the governor's office have been working to determine what is the best possible replacement program. So that's one. Second, an office conversion tax incentive, so that as we think about the more than 135 million square feet of outdated office space, especially in the post-pandemic era, right, where we have office stock that really needs to be put to good use. Those conversions can happen in a more feasible manner. And importantly, they happen with a requirement for affordable housing if this tax incentive actually is implemented. Third, we want to lift the FAR cap. Nothing brings me more joy than a really, really wonky, arcane issue like the FAR cap being in the news and people talking about it. Because you know what it is fundamentally, if you strip away all the jargon, it's about ensuring that we're able to get rid of a cap on density for homes in parts of the city that are transit rich and job rich. Let the city do that work, working with the city council, and build these homes in neighborhoods across the city. And of course, a basement program that allows us to really chart a better path to legalizing basements, especially since we have we've seen the fatal consequences, right, with Hurricane Ida of illegal basements. So those are the four main proposals, pillars of our work in Albany. While we don't know yet exactly where this is landing, the reports are showing and conversations are showing that these essential elements are going to be part of a larger framework. And I think that is good news. Already, already, right? And I totally get it. As the details come out, there's a lot of finger pointing, a lot of hand wringing, a lot of pearl clutching. These were all of the things, frankly, that happened last year when nothing happened in Albany. So when nothing happens, we do all those things. When something seems to be happening, we can also do those things. So the details, of course, matter. We have to get the policies right. But what I'm hoping is that if this framework comes together, we use it as an opportunity not to finger point, not to armchair quarterback in every single way, but to say, let's make use of these tools because that's what New Yorkers deserve. That is the type of action, then improve on them if they're not perfect. And so I'm hopeful. Maybe it'll happen today, maybe it'll happen tomorrow. We're at the 1 yard line. Let's really hope we don't fumble the ball because it's a big it's a this is a big endeavor that our partners in Albany have had to really try to advance. And we're hopeful they will do that. We've been vocal, and as the details come out, I think we need to lock arms and figure out how to implement them as best as we possibly can.
As part of what you want to see in this deal, I think this is somewhat implicit in a new 421A, but you also want to see an extension to those projects that were
Yes.
in the old program. That we say a little bit about what's at stake there, because
Sure.
that does seem like it will be part of this package, but again, we don't know. And there are thousands of units of housing on the line with the possibility of that retroactive application.
That's absolutely right. So part of the framework could include an extension of the old program. And here's why that's important. Some analysis shows that there are about 30,000 units that were vested that would have otherwise needed to have met a particular deadline. This extension ensures that those projects have a better chance of coming online. Some months ago, when it was unclear it was going to happen in Albany, we stood up in the administration a housing at-risk task force so that those projects, if there wasn't an extension that were worried whether they would be able to meet the deadline, we could work with them. We could understand what they are because the issues are not just the financial feasibility. Let's be frank, it's also kind of a regulatory maze, right? To get through DEP, DOB, whoever else. And it's a long list of agencies on the permitting side in order for those projects to complete. And there were about 17,000 units represented in the projects that raised their hand and said, we want to be part of the housing at-risk program. Nothing would make me happier than to close up shop on that program, maybe still deal with, of course, the regulatory issues so that that continues to accelerate. But there is a lot at risk, and to the extent that there's an extension, that is going to be a critical part of the package.
If in some scenario that we don't want to necessarily talk too much about at this moment, these discussions fall through, are you supportive of the governor stepping in the way she stepped in Gowanus to try to create housing through different mechanisms using the Empire State Development and other ways of sort of getting around, working around the legislature to ensure that housing development can occur using something? A semblance of a tax break. Is that something that is being discussed at this point? Is that something you'd, immediately urge her to act on to sort of take a more expanded approach to that type of effort to work around the framework?
It's a good question. I'd rather think about how much more housing we can build and how much more of a dent in the affordability crisis we can make if we have all of the tools. Because the program that you mentioned, I understand why that was stood up for the same reason the Housing at Risk program was stood up. It was a workaround. It was a break glass in case of emergency type of approach. But here's what's clear. We need an as of right predictable program. Because if you look at the old 421A program with all of its challenges, and I'm hoping that we will come to see that there are going to be major improvements to it, it's responsible for over 50% of the production that HPD financed in the last calendar year. And I think in particular in higher opportunity neighborhoods, 421A was used for over 80% of the buildings that were built since 2016. So it's critical that there is a predictable, effective, as of right program so that we don't live in the world of a laundry list of workarounds that that won't really, at the end of the day, even if you implemented them all, and I hope we don't have to, but they won't result in the type of dramatic acceleration of housing production that is needed to confront the crisis. And so when we put out a moonshot goal a year ago now of 500,000 new homes over the course of the next decade, that requires a whole lot of stuff, but including the right type of supply package in Albany.
So you mentioned 200,000 units of new housing over the last decade, 500,000 unit goal for the next decade. So that shows the gap there that we've been building new housing roughly, say, 20,000 units a year, and it really should be 50,000 units a year. So just wanted to point that out for folks, and we'll come back to that in a second. But you said something about how even the conversation around 421A has changed. And that's clearly emblematic of the broader conversation, maybe not among many people in this room and other rooms who are housing policy experts and wonks, but the broader conversation, even among elected officials, has changed significantly. You said recently that you and your team have had more than 100 one-on-one meetings with lawmakers, hundreds of broader meetings. Can you say a little bit about how the conversation has changed, and especially how you've brought some lawmakers along who have been very skeptical of the notion that there needs to be major efforts on housing supply?
Yeah. This has been, I think, the largest sea change in terms of discourse that I've seen in a while. And it actually happened in a pretty accelerated fashion, even at the start of the administration. And I mentioned even last year, the certain words were taboo. And so I think that's a result of a few things. One is that it's not just, I'm not the only person who's hearing from New Yorkers that they are facing incredible insecurity, right, in terms of housing. It's consistently in every survey, number one or number two in terms of issues facing New Yorkers. That feedback, every lawmaker is hearing, right? So that is, and with the results of the housing vacancy survey, we know that we are the housing crisis has reached a fevered pitch in this city. That is heartbreaking, but I think helps show the need for action. The second thing that is happening is that these aren't just voices of well-meaning bureaucrats and housers saying we need to do something about housing. The part that I've been most gratified to see, and this is because so many of us have done, I think, really important work to lift up voices. We're hearing this from all corners of the city. We're hearing it from labor. We're hearing it from houses of worship. We're hearing it from community developers. Of course, we're hearing it from housing and tenant advocates. We're hearing it from the business community. So that the chorus is growing, and it's a bigger and bigger tent, I think has also been helpful, not just for the discourse, but for the specific conversations about what action looks like in Albany and other levels of government. However, you know, NIMBYism has always been a bipartisan disposition. And we are under no illusion that, you know, if the New York Times editorializes or the Daily News editorializes, we got to do something about the housing crisis, that means that our work on the ground is going to be super easy. So right now, as many might know, we have three citywide tax amendments. That citywide tax amendment and carbon neutrality passed the city council last year. The City of Yes for Economic Opportunity is now at the city council. And then we have the City of Yes for Housing Opportunity, which I really do believe is the most ambitious, most impactful pro-housing set of reforms the city has ever seen. And let me tell you, we are taking nothing for granted in terms of the work on the ground, because despite the overall sea change, we still have to confront what people's concerns, questions, and fears, and not expect that the 1,000-page, and it was 1,000 pages, that 1,000-page text that we released to the public last week, that that will be easily digestible, understandable, or sufficient to ensure that every New Yorker understands that we all have to participate, that if we just build a little bit of housing in every neighborhood, we might stand a chance in this housing crisis.
I understand, by the way, some of the genesis of the City of Yes motto and nomenclature, but that was clearly sort of a brilliant branding and tactical move.
Well, you know who's copying it, right? I should have trademarked it. San Francisco mayor just came out, just had a speech a couple of weeks ago about how San Francisco needed to be a city of yes. And then the city of Chicago just, I think about a week ago, came out with a housing plan, and it was to, and it actually credited the city of New York, but it said the city of Chicago needs to build faster, build everywhere, and build together. So those are, I think they're more than taglines, but it's a way of expressing what is possible. And because housing finance and housing policy can seem like it's just in the wheelhouse of a select few of experts, it's critically important that we communicate this in simpler terms, in terms that can galvanize New Yorkers.
Well, it's about a public policy orientation and a societal orientation towards growth, and that things right. cannot stay stagnant just for those who already have secure housing
exactly
or
right.
have been able to, you know, have home ownership, for example, by buying something in the 1980s and then opposing, you know, new housing development near the property they own. But on that front and on that discussion, it strikes me that all of these negotiations in Albany, and this happens at the city level too, there's a lot of quote unquote special interests involved. And again, those interests represent lots of New Yorkers, whether they're in labor or they're tenant advocates or real estate developers, landlords. There's a lot of, so I don't say special interest even in a derogatory way, but there are, the question is, I'm curious about your perspective in these conversations about who is the focus of the conversations around housing policy and housing supply, and how do you ensure that the focus in those conversations is the people who need housing, the people who are New Yorkers now or in the future, which are very often the hardest group to sort of advocate for, right? Is the people who want to move here, who don't right. live here yet. They're not going to vote for any of these legislators or even executives in the, you know, upcoming election. But how to have you balance that? Because clearly, as part of negotiating a new 421A, good cause eviction, some of these big pieces of the puzzle, there are major interests at play who, again, should have a voice in the process, obviously, but should not necessarily design the policy. And say a little bit about that balancing act, because that's very challenging.
It is the hardest part about making policy, right? Because when the saying that whenever you're trying to craft a policy, you should ask yourself, you know, what are we trying to change and who are we trying to change it for? And so what we've done in advocating for the tools that I mentioned earlier is we've been clear from the beginning the things that we care about. We care about permanent affordability in a new program. We care about deeper affordability in a new program. We care that the labor standards are improved because we believe that we can, you know, kill two birds with one stone, both build housing and ensure that the wages are sufficient. And we care that the program actually builds housing. It must actually build housing. A program that addresses everyone's hopes and dreams, that doesn't actually boost a supply of housing, would be a hollow legislative win, right? And the same is true with the City of Yes for housing opportunity. We could pass something, we could pass a City of Yes that only has one of the many different reforms that we're calling for, but that's not sufficient. When we think about tenant protections and good cause, and I was speaking with someone earlier who represents smaller landlords, it's important to remember that the balance of going as far as we can to protect tenants, and that there are landlords in this city, smaller landlords, whose entire wealth is wrapped up in that building, and that we have to take that into consideration, is incredibly critical. And there will be those out there. What we don't want, and I don't think this is where we're going to end up. We don't want all of the programs to be the least common denominator, right? Because that won't build housing, that won't protect tenants, that won't get us office conversions with affordable. They still have to be correct programmatically and from a policy level. So we've been clear on the principles that matter to us. We have supported the program by doing the analysis and the modeling. All the brainiacs in city government, the supercomputers, have been hard at work for the last several months. And we've brought out all of the voices. And so they have, as I started with Ben, it's a very difficult job that they have to strike the right balance in each of these programs and in the package as a whole. And so I think everyone here and all of the hats that you wear, your continued advocacy, your continued research capabilities are really critical, not just in this session, but in future sessions, in the City of Yes for Housing Opportunity and the City Council level, for the federal resources. We haven't even talked about Congress. We're waiting on, we have an extraordinary opportunity, for instance, with a tax package to get more LIHTC in this city, which has been the workhorse for affordable housing. And that actually had huge bipartisan support. It passed the House like 300 plus to 70, and it's stuck with the Senate. So no shortage of opportunities to advance these issues and solve them, but at the same time, not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good.
When you say the program has to actually be something, or the package has to be something that really creates supply, obviously the ways in which they're talking about the details of a 421A replacement, even details of office conversions, the notion is attaching labor standards, is attaching affordability requirements, there are geographic limitations involved. All of these specific details, from my understanding, are still being talked about in Albany. So are there specific thresholds, warnings, anything that you can share that you say, if you do X or Y, it will make this program, again, a nice talking point, but not actually build housing?
So that has been precisely the conversation and the role that we've tried to play at the city with individual lawmakers, with those at the negotiating table. And what's hard is that these are all dials, right? So you can't saying this is exactly what you want the depth of affordability to be is, without consideration for all of the other dials in terms of the benefit framework for owners or what the labor standards are that's insufficient. And so it's really been with the analysis and the modeling, making sure everyone understands if you move this here, this is where this dial needs to go. I don't mean to be cryptic, but that is exactly how the programs work, while being crystal clear that it has to do better in terms of permanence of affordability, depth of affordability, as well as enforcement.
The governor last year had her housing compact plan, which was in essence and in brief, the idea of requiring housing growth around the state, allowing a lot of flexibility in how that's done, but offering systems for ensuring housing growth if there's interest, builders remedy type of programs and things of that nature. That effort at housing supply was put on the back burner. Maybe we'll talk about that more later. But in terms of what's on the table now and how it would coincide with City of Yes for Housing Opportunity, does that combination get you to the supply that you need, or is that still short and there will need to be other discussions next year about how to get there? Do you forecast that if the programs are designed right out of Albany now, if City of Yes for Housing Opportunity goes through similar to how it's designed, obviously the city council is going to have their say in a significant way. But does that roughly get you there?
I think it would be hugely beneficial to the city if City of Yes and what's being discussed as part of the framework, if that actually gets passed. The extension, the new program, office conversion, the FAR cap, and basements. Because if you look at the City of Yes for Housing Opportunity, it clears, for example, a lot of the regulatory issues surrounding office conversions. So if we're able to do that, and the incentive gets authorized, then you start really seeing real progress there. So they're designed to be complementary. Will that be enough? We have to do more, and we're already doing a lot of it. So part of it, when I said build faster, build everywhere, build together. So the build faster part is clearing the system of building in this city from environmental review to land use through ULURP, through permitting. And, you know, we put out a report that showed that we needed 111 reforms at least in order to build faster. We've already implemented 31, a lot more work to do. Build Everywhere is both City of Yes for Housing Opportunity plus the neighborhood rezonings, and a lot of growth, if you look at the data, has come from neighborhood rezonings in the past decade. We've launched 5 together, working very, very closely with local council members. We also have to make really good use of publicly owned land. So we announced the State of the City, an initiative called 24 and 24, 24 sites advancing, public sites advancing in the year 2024. We're about, you know, a little over a third of the way through the year. We've already reached half of our goal in terms of number of sites and units. And then we still need the federal government. So we need all of these pieces. You know, I've spoken publicly that what we need to address the housing crisis is everything, everywhere, all at once. And if you haven't seen the movie, it is phenomenal. It's been described as a phenomenally deranged sci-fi epic, which is coincidentally also how I would describe our system for building housing in this city and in this country. So, it's going to take all of that to make a dent in the crisis that we're in.
Speaking of that lens, there are some legislators in the state legislature who are sort of all of the above, have an all of the above approach. Do everything, let's move. I would say there's not necessarily the most prominent really sort of pro-housing and pro-housing supply voices that might be helpful, but there are all of the above legislators. But there's also legislators who fall more into sort of, we need to boost supply or we need to focus on tenant protections. Is this design of the package that they're putting together where in many ways the discussion is, okay, you get 421A for a version of good cause. Is that a good trade-off? Is that a good balance? Because it strikes me that in many of those discussions, the question around housing supply is not being talked about as a pro-tenant tenant.
No, that's absolutely right. I think there's the political horse trading, right, that happens. But when we boost supply, if we overcome the supply issue, nothing could be more pro-tenant. Because we have a supply issue, that is the reason why there is an imbalance of power between landlords and tenants. So rents will drop. Hopefully housing conditions, of course, will also improve, because the more there is that power imbalance, the more beholden tenants are to landlords. And so I think part of, unfortunately, part of the discourse has become that there's everything we need to do on supply, and that benefit that is beneficial to X, Y, or Z people, and then protecting tenants is only about this. I think it's all part of the same set of goals. And unless we view them in that way, unless we talk about them in that way, then necessarily the conversation is only about the political horse trading. And I think that does a disservice to what we need to do in this city.
One of the pieces of the negotiations around some version of a good cause eviction protection program is about when it will apply after new construction. Is there a threshold on that that you've urged to make sure it's 15 years, it's 30 years? Do you understand tenant advocates who say, well, if you think good cause eviction is good policy, why would you exempt just about any construction or even existing properties? Where do you sort of come in those discussions? I know, broadly speaking, you and the administration and the mayor have said we understand tenant protections in some form should be part of this agreement.
Yeah.
But again, to your earlier point, these are about sort of dials and thresholds and being very careful about design of program, while also it seems like you have a lot of sort of sympathy and understanding that people are trying to make sure that as many tenants are protected as possible from, as the governor recently put it, sort of, you know, the idea of rent gouging or something along those lines.
No, that's right. So our role has been to do a few things. One is to share as much as we can about different models across the country, where some form of this has happened, whether it's California or other parts. They may not, in some jurisdictions, it may not be called good cause, but it has some of the same tenants, so that there's some baseline of how has it worked, what has it done to the housing market. To be clear about whether it is for small landlords, or in the case of new construction, how what that time period could be that provides that additional flexibility for a policy that will be new and complicated. All that is all fluid at the moment. And again, it's about all of those dials. But in the same way with the 421A program, we have tried to be honest brokers for the voice of data and the voice of also making sure we're surfacing how in the implementation of any particular policy, how that might land. And so I think we'll see, right, how the details pan out over the course of the next several hours or days. And then we all get right back to work. Right back to work, hopefully not writing op-eds about how, you know, this was not good enough, why didn't we do this, but actually implementing as best we can in the service of New Yorkers each of these programs.
One of the pieces the governor put out as sort of the this year's alternative to the housing compact was this idea of pro-housing communities, ensuring that hundreds of millions of dollars of discretionary grants that the state has only go to communities that have in some ways declared themselves pro-housing. Is New York City in there, getting there for that classification? Is New York City by those state standards? Because it looks like there wasn't a lot of opposition in the legislature to putting that into the housing package. It's barely talked about. Is New York City going to be eligible for those grants?
I would hope so. Uh-huh. I do think what we're trying to do here through the city of Yes, and we're doing the technical, taking the steps technically to be part of it, of course. But between the Speaker of City Council, the Fair Housing Framework that passed into law recently, and the City of Yes for Housing Opportunity that will hopefully come through the City Council by the end of the year, two very, very important policies and sets of tools that I think would more than qualify us as being a pro-housing community. And of course, to the extent that unlocks additional resources for the type of work that needs to happen, all the better. Never turn down a dime in this work. And I hope that there will be another opportunity for a larger set of carrots and sticks across the state, because we're in a regional economy, right? We can't think about housing as just a New York City problem, the same way we can't think about transportation as just a New York City challenge. So if we need to ultimately take that regional view in order to make a real dent on these longstanding issues.
That's exactly where I was going next. So, just between us and everybody here,
Okay.
the idea of the housing compact framework you'd like to see revisited.
I would like to see it. I would like to see this issue tackled seriously with carrots and sticks across the country. Because our housing crisis, it's not a blue state issue. It's not just a red state issue. It's blue, red, purple. And very few, I think it's like 7% of counties across the country, can a family with two minimum wage earners afford rent at a particular level that's like pretty reasonable. So we're all feeling this. It has eroded not just the opportunity for growth in many areas, but it has caused extraordinary strain for everyday Americans, everyday New Yorkers. I mean, think about the fact that we have over, 150,000 people sleeping in our shelters, right? So every day we don't take action is another day that family has to sleep in a shelter. At some point, I think there needs to be a real reckoning. And so whether it's the housing compact in New York State or a really aggressive set of policies across the country, these are the minimum, in my mind, requirements in order to not just propel growth, but be faithful to our identity as a country and, as a city and as a country that allows for the type of mobility that people deserve.
It's interesting because in a lot of ways, the discussion around the housing compact and sort of broader required growth of housing was focused on the suburbs of New York City. But there's a lot of reaches of New York City where, and you're trying to tackle this somewhat in housing in City of Yes for Housing Opportunity, is that there has just been so little growth in some parts of the five boroughs and a lot of opposition to the idea of more growth in those areas. And you're taking an ambitious yet careful, modest approach to housing growth across the city in this remaking of the zoning code, which again can be the biggest change in decades and also careful and modest, right? But there are parts of New York City where that's also very applicable,
That's
right? And that there was opposition. 421A very often and the replacement is a workaround for what is unanimously, I think, seen as a broken property tax system. When does that discussion happen? When does the discussion around wholesale property tax reform really occur? There was a commission under the last administration. Everything got stalled, pandemic and other reasons. Recommendations came out, but at the very end, the mayor has expressed support for this, but it's a huge lift. When does that conversation happen?
Well, I think the conversations have been happening. As you mentioned, the mayor's been clear that something does need to change. And so I'm hopeful that that happens soon. I mean, we have no shortage of broken systems, right, in this city. And so that's an important one. And it is complicated. Talk about having a lot of voices involved in that conversation, but we clearly need to tackle it for all of the obvious reasons, including that we're otherwise forced to kind of mangle ourselves through different, tax abatement programs because of some of those inequities and some of those challenges.
Tell me if this is a wrong read, but my sense of the equation is that this is only going to move through Albany if the city really makes it a priority and takes it there. Again, this is another issue where there don't seem to be state legislators who are driving the bus on property tax reform. There's, little interest here and there. But is that the only way that it eventually happens in Albany, is if a mayoral administration says this is now the next top priority and maybe you have to do all this triage and these specific pieces first that you've been working on? But is that the way it happens?
I never try to say how things happen in Albany.
Yeah. Okay. Fair.
And it's why I have persisted through three administrations. And so what I do know is that whatever the set of really important issues are, you know, the city has a really important role to play in doing that analysis and crafting what recommendations for that policy and galvanizing the right types of coalitions, whether that's on housing or mayoral control or on public safety. And I have no doubt we're going to do that on this issue as well.
We're getting close to just taking a couple of audience questions. There's a couple of microphones. If maybe just two at most people on each side want to line up, we'll take a couple of questions from each of these two microphones if you want to get ready on those. But we're just going to take a couple from each microphone in a moment. Everything Everywhere All at Once. I'm not just asking this question because there's a big NYCHA crowd here, but this has actually been another area where the mayor and the speaker of the city council have talked about development on NYCHA land. And you have a very interesting experiment moving ahead not far from here in terms of a tear down and rebuild with additional infill housing. Where's that on the menu? Is that something you want to be more aggressive about, or is there so much going on already that that's not really something you're looking at?
There's no such thing as there's too much going on. We have a multiple set of challenges in the city, and we have to be energetic about all of them. I'm glad you mentioned that. The other sea change in this administration is that when we talk about the housing plan and the housing agenda, we don't say all the things we say, and then, by the way, whatever's happening in NYCHA is over here. The housing plan, Housing Our Neighbors, Chapter 1 was NYCHA. Chapter 2 is homelessness. And so there has been a real recognition that these are all intertwined. And so we have been working with the right type of urgency and commitment to make sure that we are helping with the transformation and preservation of NYCHA. And I wake up every day just so grateful that Lisa Bova Hyatt and her incredible team are at the helm of NYCHA, because across the board, from compliance with the main tenets of the HUD agreement to the transformation project programs like PACT, and now like the TRUST program, right? That a lot of advocacy to get that approved by the state. And since then, a number of developments have voted or in the voting process. A major win at Nostrand Houses just a few months ago voted overwhelmingly for change and for the trust. And their preliminary results from Bronx River Addition, another 100 or so households there, where the preliminary results, record turnout, 61%, 85% of those who voted also voted for change, and an overwhelming number for the trust. So I mention all of this because it is so important that our work in NYCHA be central to thinking about housing affordability in the city, and it has been. And we can only do that because of the incredible team at NYCHA, and because we are sober about the fact that despite all of those gains, NYCHA faces an $80 billion capital need. And so whether it's the model at Fulton Chelsea Elliott or real acceleration of PACT and trust, not letting the feds walk away from their obligation to support NYCHA on the capital and operating side, all of that too. So also with NYCHA, everything everywhere, all at once.
Including more development.
But do it in a way where it's resident driven. And I don't mean that in like you know, we sometimes it's too easy to say, well, with the right form of community engagement, we can do X, Y, and Z. If you look at the model at Folsom Tulsi Elliott, driven by residents, the trust model, driven, but literally voted on by residents, and that has to be sincere. It has to, that process has to be sincere, and people need to see the results of the trust that they are, that they have given to NYCHA and to other and to public officials in each of this process. So to the extent that that goes well, I think it could be an incredible model of building more housing on NYCHA developments while at the same time creating, preserving forever the affordability of NYCHA units. So I'm bullish about it.
Okay, we have three people up, so let's take those three questions and then we'll wrap up our event. Go ahead, sir, please.
Thank you very much. And my name is Ken Brown. I have the privilege of being the district manager of Bronx Community Board 5. Let me begin by thanking New York Law School. Really appreciate these breakfast talks. I have yet to regret coming here, so good job.
Good job.
regarding, I'd like to push back a little bit about the notion of, what is it, building everywhere, everything, all the time?
It's an approximation.
But... Right, right. Particularly around the removing or liberalizing the FAR cap. In our district, there is tremendous pressure, and I'm sure this is ubiquitous, on single family homes. I get reports of people almost literally offering bags of money for single family homes. People are under a lot of pressure. They sell, these parcels get bundled together, and we have a needle, as people call it, of 16 stories in the middle of what had hitherto been a residential community. So my concern is that with the liberalization around FAR requirements, this will put increased pressure on single family homes. So what is being, why the FAR liberalization now? Why not, for example, do it after the office conversions? Because my understanding is that will open up a large, potentially a large tract of affordable units or units for residential. Why do the FAR, why not do the FAR after that? And what protections are there within this liberalization of the housing within City of Yes for Housing for the protection and preservation of single family homes?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think those are questions that, and I appreciate the spirit in which they were asked. And this, these are the questions we have to answer in every neighborhood, right? On the FAR cap, I want to be clear. The state has an artificial cap on FAR in many districts of the city. That they lift the cap doesn't mean that there's unfettered development across the city. It would still have to go through ULURP. It's a public process, right? And so, and in order to take advantage of higher densities, and the same way we do in any project that goes through ULURP, all of the particular concerns that and questions that communities have will need to be answered. But it really is for transit-rich and job-rich areas of Manhattan. That is really where we think, or in certain, whether it's downtown Brooklyn, I think Jamaica as well, where there is a real, where that cap has prevented the type of growth and type of density that we can build. And for lower density districts, I also want to be clear about the changes and proposals, like what they mean. What we mean here isn't unfettered development. What we mean here are the types of modest changes, the kind of town center, you know, a few stories near either, you know, above commercial strips or near transit. We see it all the time. It's kind of the workhorse of our housing stock in New York. We just actually made it illegal to build that type of housing in too many parts of our city. And so in the low density between those two that I just mentioned and thinking about parking minima and thinking about accessory dwelling units that really, I think, stand to benefit intergenerational families, a caregiver, a child trying to live in your neighborhood after they've come back from college. an elder who otherwise won't have be able to generate income or can't downsize because of how the rents are. Those are the modest changes. And they might be modest in any particular neighborhood, but if we do it everywhere, that's where you have the really, the dramatic collective impact. And so that, as we go through the City of Yes process, I think we have to answer all of those questions in every neighborhood. But be sure that we are being clear, because I also think there's quite a bit of disinformation out there. You know, I got a letter the other day saying they oppose the City of Yes for housing opportunity because it will spell the eradication of sunlight in New York. Like, that's not going to be the case. So we have to work overtime, right? Overtime, to make sure that it's clear what is actually being proposed, and that and we're clear about its impacts. When you look at the number, and I'll end my response to this on with this note, when you look at the out migration of certain families in the city, in particular Black families, who can no longer afford to live in too many neighborhoods of this city, we really have to ask ourselves and be clear about what is at stake. Our city changing so that it doesn't feel and look like what it always has been, what's made it great, certainly has to be more important than what I think are this. I know this isn't what you said, sir, but we hear across different neighborhoods that it's about their way of life, it's about neighborhood character, it's about their views. We have to change the conversation and be clear about what is really at stake in terms of the actions that we stand to take.
I have to let the deputy mayor go. If you get me your questions, I'll make sure we get an answer from her team. I apologize for those who are at the mic. We will get you an answer, but we do have to wrap up. Thank you, Deputy Mayor Maria Torres Springer.